This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
First of all, there's no moral authority that non-natives have to tell other people they don't belong here. So let's just get that straight. No moral authority. Now, one can make economic arguments, you know, and one can make pragmatic arguments about why we need to manage immigration better or limit immigration. But I have zero tolerance for any non-native person telling other people they don't belong here, because that just makes us laugh. I mean, who said they could be here? You know, they forced their way in and stole a bunch of stuff and massacred people. I mean, come on.
See, that's the thing about coming from somewhere else. There's always going to be someone there before you, and there are always going to be reasons, legitimate or otherwise, to tell you why you should leave. Hi, this is the third episode of The Pendatang Cometh, a four-part series about what it means to come to a new country using the United States as our lens. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Over the last fortnight, this is what we've covered. Why people want to come and how hard they have to work to gain a foothold just to stay, never mind thrive. Today, the inevitable, the pushback.
So the problem is these hordes of Asian people that UCLA accepts into our school every single year, which is fine. But if you're going to come to UCLA, then use American manners. In America, we do not talk on our cell phones in the library. I'll be like deep into my studying, into my political science theories and arguments and all that stuff, getting it all down, like typing away furiously, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, when I'm about to like reach an epiphany, over here from somewhere, oh, ching chong ling long ting tong.
This is the flip side of trying to make a home somewhere. People get defensive about their homes, especially when they've been building for generations. They want it to be exactly as they've made it. They're suspicious about newcomers who seem to be riding on the coattails of their hard work. Who are you, the tone seems to be, to come here conveniently right after I've spent years constructing the walls and putting up the curtains? This is where discrimination begins to creep in. Here's Patty Chang, San Franciscan entrepreneur, describing her aunt and uncle's decision not to have children because of it.
They thought this discrimination so strongly in the 1960s when they're at the University of Oregon in Eugene that they made a huge decision to never have children because they didn't want to raise children in America that they thought might be really hurt by the discrimination that they would face.
She wasn't exempt herself.
I know because I look different from the majority of the people I went to school with. Starting in kindergarten, I was teased. I was teased for my nose not being, for being so flat. Kids would put spoons on their nose during lunch and say, "Daddy, you can't hold a spoon on your nose if you don't have a nose, it's so flat." Or they would say, "Oh, you can't, how do you breathe through that nose? You don't even have a nose, you have like two holes in your face."
And it wasn't just her nose either, the looks were certainly a theme.
I was made fun of because my eyes were not the same. They would sing nasty songs back in the 70s when I was growing up. They would sing like Ching Chong, Chinese, Japanese, Dirty Knees, what are these? And they would hold their fingers to their corners of their eyes. And when they would say Chinese, they would pull them up so they would, their eyes would slant up. And when they would say Japanese, they'd pull the corners of their eyes down. I hated that. And they would sing that all the time and tease me.
We can't help what we're born with, but sometimes it's even about what someone might be wearing on any given day to hear Rafael Rios tell it.
I have had experiences even after coming back and having actually become a lawyer and working where clearly if I walk into a store downtown, and I've had this experience multiple times, and during the summer, you know, you usually are walking around here in shorts and maybe, you know, a polo shirt or a T-shirt. If I walk into a store like that, you know, a number of times walked in and I've gotten very different treatment than when I've walked in, say I've been in my office and I walk in and I'm in a suit or at least a, you know, my button-down shirt and slacks. Very different treatment.
He recognizes that he's someone with privilege and standing. Others might not be so lucky.
And I know certainly, you know, I have kind of progressed kind of in our local society here where the farm workers, we still have a lot of seasonal farm workers that come in. you know, again, still most of them are Mexican. And the treatment, you know, of the farm workers in certain places, certain times, is definitely, obviously different than the treatment that I get.
These personal stories are not fun to hear, but many of us, you know, on some level will have experienced this anyway, when we've walked somewhere and suddenly realized that nobody else looks like us and are instead looking at us. But it's a lot more insidious when it rises to a systemic level.
The biggest obstacle is coming to a new country and hearing all the hateful, mean things, getting over the fear. I think the biggest obstacle for the immigrant is just the whole idea of being in another country and being in a country that is in the midst of their own turmoil about what they think about immigration. And they come here and they have no status.
I'll come back to that point about not having a status later, but for now, just know this. It opens the door to all manner of abuse, and people might not even know the right places to seek the help they need.
So they're abused, they're taken advantage of, the terminology of the legal system is different from their country. I did my sabbatical in Guatemala, and in Guatemala, the name of an attorney is called an abogado notario. So if you're an abogado, that's a lawyer, but if you're an abogado notario, you are a special cut and a privileged lawyer. So they come here, they see Notary Republic, they think they are speaking to the elite when they're just speaking to somebody that can take an oath. And then they get charged $3,000 for their services, which are usually ignorant services.
Things only get worse from there.
Once they give the wrong information, two bad things happen. One, they have declared where they're at. And number two, the wrong information can result in a 3 or a 10 year bar from ever applying again. So fear, language, the whole issue of the country in turmoil against them. And yet at the same time, the country is sending mixed signals because they want them in terms of their labor.
Dr. Alejandro Mendez of the Immigration Alliance clearly remembers the moment when he decided he needed to do something.
And as the director of Hispanic Ministries, I'd go into a church and there would be a wife with kids and asking me to do something, and her husband had been taken. And I was hearing this and seeing this, and I would come back to the office and I would say, we've got to do something. And the church's answer was, this is a political thing. This is not something for us. And so I basically went to the president and I said, so our mission means multiplying healthy churches among legal people. And he said, no, all people. Well, then we've got to do something.
Okay, so legality. We're entering tricky territory here. Who are these people coming and staying illegally? Clara Long of the Human Rights Watch explains how easy it is to overstay. It's the simplest thing.
A lot of the political debate focuses on securing the southern border, which really leaves out this fact that about half of the undocumented population in the U.S. are actually people who overstayed visas. So they came legally, and as, say, a tourist or a student, and they overstayed their visa, and now they're here in an unauthorized manner.
If you know any Malaysians who have jumped ship, this is likely the route they took as well, according to our ambassador, His Excellency Datuk Dr. Awang Ade.
The other group are the Malaysian diasporas. These are those that stay on longer than their visas permit or their passports allow. So these are the problem ones. But sometimes they choose to do that quietly. So they don't even come to us in the embassies because they don't want people to know. So they may have some problems. Sometimes the police catch them, then they get sent home. And they have families here, they have young children. I really don't know how many of them, probably not that many, not as many as some from some other countries.
So you've stayed past your visa date, the empty seat of your return ticket has flown or driven home without you, and you find yourself in a new neighbourhood in a new city. What now? Sybil Fox provides some insight into what living illegally is like.
Come like that. Some come without a high school education, with no money, and they struggle in very low-wage work. If they don't have legal status, they're
at the mercy of the federal government. They can be deported at any time, and that puts them at the mercy of their employers, too, or others who might report them to the Immigration Service. If they don't have legal status, it may be hard for them, depending on where they live, to have a driver's license. It will be hard for them to get jobs that pay a decent wage.
It's not just themselves that migrants have to worry for, but also their children.
If their children are unauthorized too, they, even if they are able to finish high school and get a college education, we have many students at UC Berkeley who don't have legal status. It can be hard for them to use those skills that they've learned, the education that they've earned, and translate that into paying jobs. And many immigrants today are from places in Asia and Latin America, and they face some discrimination in the labor market and in American society more broadly. And this can also impede their social mobility in the United States.
Which translates into having to live in poorer neighborhoods, and the rest then has been played out in any movie that has labeled itself as urban since, I don't know, the 70s.
Those poor communities tend to have worse schools, they're more dangerous places to live, and it's harder for those families and for their children to grow up healthy, to have a decent education, and to have a fair shot in life.
Depending on the count, 11 million people could be living like that. I'll say that again, 11 million. Or at least that's what Clara is suggesting. She's calling for change.
The policy with regard to this population in particular has become untenable and from our perspective, abusive. You know, in order to fulfill and protect and respect the human rights of this large unauthorized population, the U.S. must pass an immigration reform that would allow this enormous proportion of the population to sort of come out of the shadows.
But change is slow in coming, and Professor Giovanni Perry has some idea why that might be.
The big hurdle is this idea that the undocumented immigrant need to be, punished somehow, and there could not be a regularization unless there is some punitive measure against them, which to me is impractical, it's not very well founded.
In the meantime, the system, broken as it is, grinds on. Up next, a closer look at border security and deportation, and perhaps most importantly, what do Native Americans make of the squabbling over what was once all theirs? You're listening to The Pendatan Kamuth, BFM 89.9.
Of course, we also play a huge part with partnering with all our federal law enforcement agencies, state law enforcement agencies, as well as international law enforcement agencies. So we are all on the same page with regards to systematically, worldwide, globally, fighting all threats to all, mankind.
What is this agency that has this power, this much responsibility? You're listening to The Pendatan Kamuth, a series observing the intricacies of immigration through the looking glass of America. I'm Lee Chui Lin. You might have recognized the voice of Sidney Aki of the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol. We've spoken to him before. According to Romal Javero, another agent, this is what they do.
Okay, when we encounter an individual that is undocumented, that's arrested from any country, process is what we place them under our arrest, take them to a station along the immediate border there, and in there, once we take them into the station, we process them by entering their fingerprints into a biographical system, biographical identification system, and then from that point on, we're able to determine whether they're also a criminal. The database is connected to the FBI database, which lets us know if they've been arrested prior by any state or local police department or any federal agency.
These are the people who are responsible for controlling the borders, keeping the riffraff out. But who are the riffraff? And if you'll pardon me the cliché, who watches the watchmen?
We have a huge problem in the United States with the accountability of the Border Patrol and of the agency in which it's housed, which is called the Customs and Border Protection. These agencies are encountering a crisis of accountability. We've seen Border Patrol agents shoot and kill over 36 people in the last 4 years. And still there is no accountability for any of those deaths of migrants, sometimes U.S. citizens, sometimes people who are actually not in the U.S. but who are standing in Mexico at the time of their death.
Clara Long is trying to, and what she's watching is cause for concern.
In 2006, there was a decision made to increase the staffing of the Border Patrol by 21,000 agents within a very short period of time. And besides the human rights abuses, you know, what our research has shown on this is that increasing a force that quickly has enormous effects in terms of who you're hiring and whether you're getting any so-called bad apples. We've had high officials go on the record to say that because of the rapid hiring processes of the Border Patrol, mostly between 2006 and 2010, there are so many bad apples in that agency, it's going to take a whole generation to weed them out. Now, that's a problem for abuses against migrants, but it's also a problem for border security. Having agents who are not fit to be in a law enforcement role, who may be corrupt, who may be abusive and not receiving the proper oversight, also means that the border is less secure.
Sidney Aki, however, insists that Border Patrol agents are trained and have access to cutting-edge technology.
But in addition to technology, we also have, of course, our officers, who are our bread and butter, our foundation with regards to using the expertise and experience to talk to people, interview people, identify differing stories, identify anomalies and whatnot, which, of course, leads to further inspection of the individual as well as their vehicle or whatever conveyances they are entering the United States with.
When we went to the States early in the year for this project, a helicopter had just fired at a suspected smuggling boat off Southern California for the first time. All this upgrades, all this escalation, it's in service of security, a wide-ranging word, as it's applied indeed to a wide-ranging border.
Well, you know, our primary goal with the United States Border Patrol is to protect America. And, you know, although we enforce our legacy duties of immigration law, our priority is to prevent terrorists and terrorist weapons from entering our country and also to disrupt and degrade transnational criminal organizations.
That's Romuald again. You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone in the world, except terrorists, who disagree with the fact that terrorism must be kept out. However, it's not just terrorists that they're concerned with, but criminals. And that's where we run into some trouble, because there's this.
It could be from illegal narcotics, it could be human smuggling, counterfeit documents, it could be warrants of arrest on state and or federal charges here in the United States. Any threat that could be a potential threat to ourselves, our communities, our families, and our homeland.
And then there's also this.
These are criminal prosecutions for illegal entry and reentry. They're at incredible levels. They're 40% of U.S. federal criminal prosecutions. So it's an enormous part of what the criminal justice system at the federal level in the United States is doing, is prosecuting people who have entered the border, entered the U.S. from mostly from the southern border in an unauthorized way. That's caused enormous problematic effects. One is that these prosecutions sweep up at a higher proportion these people, as you mentioned before, who are parents of U.S. citizen children. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, we speak with migrants, and we've spoken with migrants who have told us, I would rather be, you know, it doesn't matter if they put me in prison, I have to be with my family. I have to keep trying to be with my family. And so these are people who prison will not deter from crossing into the United States.
Clara goes on to tell us how this plays out.
Nonetheless, the U.S. persists in prosecuting and putting in prison these nonviolent migrants who are, you know, essentially being criminalized for their need to be with their family.
Family is a force not to be underestimated. The refrain of, I'm going to bring my parents here, is one we heard a lot on the trip, and you can replace parents in that sentence with any other family member without dulling its strength. The pull of love, responsibility, and obligation is a potent cocktail. Some of Tisha Gomez's family joined her here, but her brother experienced the difficulty of trying to keep a family together across borders.
He kind of adapted to the life here and tried to bring his wife and son, but it never worked out. They were never able to come, could not get visas, and my brother could not go and visit them because, like me in the beginning, he was not legal here. So eventually the marriage fell apart, which is very common for some immigrants who leave young family, you know, back home. So he got married here to an American and had two other kids. And eventually he went back to visit.
Her sister fared worse.
My sister, unfortunately, was not so lucky. She was stopped on a traffic light, and for some reason they didn't like the way she presented herself or something, and they took her in and found out that she was an illegal immigrant, so they just deported her. So when you hear illegally, there is a lot of things that you have to watch for and avoid. And for her, it was unfortunately just, bad luck.
Sad as it is, her story is not unique. Dr. Mandis has a story like this in his family as well.
I have family members who married Mexicans, and they really were married, and they had three children together. And they were standing, waiting on that side over there for the paperwork. And after a few years, they of going back and forth on the bridge to be with his family in Mexico, he finally did the honorable thing, and that was to unite his family on this side of the river. So people are always having to make those really, really tough decisions.
And then what happens? You live in fear because if you get caught, there's criminal prosecution, there's deportation, there's the possibility of not seeing the faces of those you love for years. And then what's next for you?
For many people, let's say, who have been deported away from their families, there is no recourse. There is no way to appeal the deportation, particularly on the basis of their deep ties and family ties in the United States. For a few cases, there may be, and we've a little bit of action in that regard, but the answer on a whole is that U.S. deportation law does not sort of take into account, up until now and up until the Obama's executive actions on immigration, which happened in November, does not take into account for the vast majority of people affected.
Immigration's always been an issue that inflames passions. That's not surprising. There are few things that are more important to us as a society than who gets to come here and call our country home? Who gets the privilege of becoming a citizen of the United States of America? That's a big deal. When we talk about that in the abstract, it's easy sometimes for the discussion to take on a feeling of us versus them. And when that happens, a lot of folks forget that most of us used to be them. We forget that. I mean, it's really important for us to remember our history. Unless you're one of the first Americans, a Native American, you came from someplace else. Somebody brought you.
From looking out to looking in, I think it would have been impossible and disrespectful to not address the story and the worries of one group of people who get overlooked in the swirl of immigration, perhaps because their migration was so long ago. Within the country itself, Native Americans were forcibly relocated by governments formed indeed by those very first migrants of long ago and their ancestors. And it appears to be a migration that still hasn't fully come to a stop. Uncle Dave Washington, medicine man of the Hopi tribe, has lived out on the reservation here in Arizona. It's a sparse, beautiful place, but harsh. Orange sand and rock dotted with scrub and marked by the pictographs of the people who've come and gone.
Yeah, so the migrations, they took many millennia to get to this point here. And people ask us, why you live way out here in the rocks and deserts? This is where we're set to live, and we won't be bothered here. But now they're finding minerals and things in the earth, and they want it. They want it.
I've been spending a lot of time focusing on how hard it is to come to a new place, but it's certainly no easy thing to leave either.
Imagine a people building a whole town and having to leave it. The town's there, the homes are there, but they're instructed to leave it, so they left them. And our ancestors were instructed to leave them because that's proof that we were here. And what happens a lot is they're destroyed. These petroglyphs are shot and destroyed because they don't want no evidence of Hopis in the area. So
certainly for people that were raised in land-based communities, often on reservations, I guess I could argue that there's a sense of continuous belonging between them and their ancestors. But the other thing you have to remember is Native American people were forcibly relocated. Say, you've got a lot of tribes in Oklahoma that came from the east, actually, and they were forcibly relocated into what was Indian territory.
Kim Tolbert is associate professor of anthropology. She's currently at the University of Alberta. Her tribe has also been forced to move in the past.
I'm a Dakota person, and we are roughly in the area where our ancestors hunted and moved through occasionally, but my ancestors were also forcibly relocated from what is today St. Paul, Minnesota, onto reservations in eastern South Dakota. So luckily for us, it's a similar landscape, and we could sort of continue a lot of those land-based practices, and our spirituality is often rises up in relationship to particular land bases and particular land forms. And so for us, we were, I think, able to continue those kind of land-informed practices perhaps more than some Native people were.
She has strong, uncompromising views on what it means to be American and to belong.
There are many Americans that have Native American ancestry, but I have ancestry in France. That doesn't make me French. So it's the claiming to be Native American. It's the desire to craft a heritage from engagement with Native American mascots. You hear the mascot defenders saying this all, this is tradition, this is heritage, we're honoring you. People will claim, you know, we're honoring Native American heritage by wanting to be indigenous. I think there is a very strong desire to feel that one belongs in this land base. I think there's a strong desire to not be associated with invasion and colonization.
In other words, she was a dream to speak to. We spoke a little about why people are so eager to have even the tiniest drop of Native blood.
The Indigenous claims in particular, I think, are quite often about wanting to belong and wanting to disown affiliation with colonial history.
But she also challenged the very idea of America being an immigrant nation, which is such a fundamental point. I wish I'd gotten there first.
Because it's quote-unquote an immigrant nation, although that term erases the fact that slaves were not, they did not immigrate here, right? They were forced to come here. So I don't like that term for multiple reasons. But I think, you know, many people are always looking back to Europe, or they're looking back to Europe, looking back to Asia, looking back to Africa, and describing themselves in those ways. And so we already have that tendency of, you know, you'll have an Irish American talk about being Irish. Well, they're not Irish, they're Irish American, but it's a very common American thing to do, as if there's no difference.
Kim Tolbert opened our episode, and I also think she should close it. Because when it comes to immigration, there's always a squabble over who got there first, as if being here one or two or 10 generations somehow gives ascendancy, when it shouldn't wipe out the fact that, firstly, everybody came from somewhere else. Secondly, even if that were the case, it's the first people, the Native Americans, the Orang Asli, who win all. Or at least they should. But that's never how it plays out.
First of all, there's no moral authority that non-natives have to tell other people they don't belong here. So let's just get that straight. No moral authority. Now, one can make economic arguments, you know, and one can make pragmatic arguments about why we need to manage immigration better or limit immigration. But I have zero tolerance for any non-native person telling other people they don't belong here, because that just makes us laugh. I mean, who said they could be here? You know, they forced their way in and stole a bunch of stuff and massacred people. I mean, come on. You know, and then to turn around and say that indigenous people or brown people from elsewhere in the Americas don't belong here. Yeah, so again, that's a different kind of argument. Let's stay away from those arguments. And I certainly understand that we probably need to have very practical arguments about how to deal with immigration. So it's alarming to me the sort of racism and moralizing that goes on around that debate in this country by white people, basically.
Next week on The Pendatang Cometh, it's our fourth and final episode in the series, and it's an examination of identity. I'm Lee Chui Lin. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.